Conspiracy theories during a pandemic. Conspiracy theories have been around for a long, long time. Many ancient Romans, for example, apparently didn't believe that the Emperor Nero had killed himself. They thought it was a hoax. Conspiracy theories have fueled anti-Semitism for centuries. Some people still don't believe man has walked on the moon. But the current moment, a pandemic in the internet information age, has been a perfect storm of opportunity for those promoting unsubstantiated and often dangerous claims. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll talk with experts who study conspiracy theories about why humans are susceptible to them, how to spot them, and how to push back. And we want to hear from you. Are you skeptical of all conspiracy theories, or are there reasons to be skeptical of the skeptics? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. As if the COVID-19 crisis isn't causing enough challenges, a slew of pandemic-related conspiracy theories have surfaced that stir up controversy and confusion. This phenomenon is nothing new. Today, we'll talk about how conspiracy theories proliferate and why some people believe them. My guests are Stephanie Kelly Romano. She is an associate professor and chair of the Rhetoric, Film, and Screen Studies Department at Bates College. She began researching conspiracies in graduate school. At Bates, she teaches a class on conspiracy rhetoric. And also with us, Ryan Neville Shepherd, an assistant professor of communication at the University of Arkansas. His scholarship examines the communication of political outsiders, especially the growing appeal of political conspiracy theories. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have an example of a conspiracy theory that you've heard? What do you think makes some of these theories catch on? You can send an email to talk@mainpublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Stephanie, we're going to start with a basic definition. What exactly is a conspiracy theory? How is it different than, say, for example, propaganda?
Well, that's kind of one of the million-dollar questions, right?
We'll start with it.
That's the easy one, but that's really a difficult question to answer. A conspiracy theory, or at least as we're going to talk about it today, is primarily thought of as a narrative that has some sort of explanatory power, right? It's a story that explains something that's often contrary to the official explanation. And conspiracy theories, as we're talking about today, oftentimes have some sort of covert group of people who are manipulating or somehow arranging the situation. So for the most part, I think that's how people think about conspiracy theories. It's oftentimes immediately thought of as those things that are untrue or outlandish, which, you know, is also debatable.
Okay. Ryan, why do human beings believe conspiracy theories, especially those that are outlandish?
Well, I think sometimes people start because conspiracy theories always have a grain of truth in them, right? So I agree with Stephanie's definition, but I'd add that they also have a component there that has some evidence, oftentimes copious amounts of evidence that make them seem quite believable. But usually they contain some sort of leap in logic, which is where most people stop, at least being a hardcore believer, but maybe just a sympathizer. But I'd also say there's an underlying condition that might make people believe in certain kinds of conspiracy theories, such as political polarization, feelings of a perceived threat, just feeling like the world is sort of an unsafe, miserable place makes one a little bit more prone to believe in them.
Stephanie, what are some of the more prevalent conspiracy theories that are circling out there? And I want to step away. I'm going to ask Ryan which ones are apply to COVID-19. What are some of the others out there that have been out there for a while that many people will have heard?
Well, I think that like what Ryan was saying in terms of people feeling unsafe is obviously one of the key things going on now with COVID. Also, the fact that people don't have information. A lack of information is certainly going to make people more likely to seek out information for that feeling of security. And so, that both the unsafeness and kind of the uncertainty that's around make COVID explanations, at least even the seeking of information, give people a sense of security. So while we're home, you know, locked in our houses, people are searching the internet and they're looking for ways to prevent it or ways to cure it or when, how it started. And so basically people are just looking for information. And when we don't have a lot of it, these conspiracy theories can bubble up and fill in that space.
Okay. And so some of those, Ryan, some of those might be that a certain drug is working or that the Chinese have done this intentionally.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of misinformation about COVID right now. But I think the ones that are taking the form of conspiratorial narratives are those that are trying to attribute some sort of shadowy group with some sort of bad action to dominate the world. So if you are aware of the Plandemic video that was circulating on the internet that is being taken off a lot of the YouTube and similar sites, that's a theory that it's a virus that's created in a lab that's trying to make big pharma rich. And that it implicates a number of people in the U.S. government and even China. So that's what we're hearing right now is the dominant conspiracy theory, but we're definitely hearing others, such as the 5G conspiracy theories, which is causing some people to torch 5G towers all across the world.
Ryan, who is behind these? You know, you mentioned the video Plandemic, or who is there an organized group making these, and are they trying to sow this paranoia intentionally?
It's hard to know. I think the most obvious group that we're seeing are anti-vaccination groups. So a lot of the same types of people who would have been around the documentary called Vaxxed are the same kinds of people who are involved in this conspiracy theory and pushing it out there. There is probably a lot of suspicion that there is misinformation flying from perhaps even sort of foreign governments to try to sow cynicism in our government. But I definitely think that there are a lot of players, but the main ones that I've been seeing right now are anti-vaccination groups.
Mm. Stephanie, you teach a class on the rhetoric of conspiracy theorists. What are some of the phrases, some of the words, some of the tropes that you look for when you're looking at these that you see that are sort of red flags that come up right away?
One of the things that comes up most often and most quickly is this notion of there's a we and there's a them. And we have the information and we are trying to stay safe, but they are doing bad things and they are giving us misinformation and disinformation. So when people are put into camps like that really easily and quickly, then oftentimes that's an indication that there's something else going on there. I know one of the places I've seen that recently is with the surfacing of the conspiracy theory that the coronavirus is actually just a hoax and it's deliberately being manufactured in order to prevent the reelection of President Trump. And so immediately we get like what Ryan was talking about earlier, that political polarization. And so it immediately has a much larger significance.
Mm-hmm.
To jump
go ahead,
in
Ryan.
There,
yeah.
If you were to watch the Plandemic video, which I did because everybody was talking about it online, you hear a lot of the sort of tropes of conspiracy theories. So you hear about great forces trying to control the world. You hear humanity is being killed by a hidden agenda. You hear about a great cover-up. You hear devil figures like Bill Gates and the U.S. Army. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of the same recycled tropes that we've heard in a lot of other conspiracy theories.
You mentioned Bill
right.
Gates.
Go ahead,
Stephanie. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, and in terms of the specific rhetorical devices that are used to advance those tropes, what we oftentimes have is we have, you know, what they call evidence dumping or webbing, which is basically just any piece of information can be manipulated and strategically positioned to support the conspiracy. And the most common example of that is if you can't find evidence for the conspiracy, that is simply evidence of exactly how brilliant and manipulative those conspirators are, right? And so you have kind of the random association of virtually everything and the connection of things which support those tropes and advance them.
Is part of this, and I'll throw this to you first, Ryan, is part of the reason that the pandemic seems to be so susceptible to conspiracy theories flourishing is because the information, there's so much that is unknown, and the good information is changing week by week. So it's not as though the earth circles the sun or the sun circles the earth. It's something that every week we're learning something new. Does that make this situation, all of us, a little more vulnerable?
Well, I think there are many things. I think we're in the middle of a pandemic that is causing people to be desperate and upset and angry, and that's reasonable. But I also do think that we are hearing a lot of different things from our government, which creates a lot of inconsistency, and it creates a lot of evidence that the government might not be telling us the full truth. And so at first we were told that masks wouldn't make us safe, and then we were told that masks would make us safe. That feeds into the skepticism and paranoia that people have about events, but especially about events that are really, really big that have a major impact on people's lives.
Mm. Yeah, Stephanie, yeah, go ahead.
That, Jennifer, I just add to that that relatedly, I think there's also this piece about people don't want to be wrong. People don't want to have to dial back on what they've said is true, because some of these conspiracy theories are entire worldviews, and so they become really tightly attached to people's identities. And so they don't want to lose face with that. And so to say I'm wrong, you know, is something that in our culture is currently not necessarily heralded as lovely, you know?
Yeah. Well, and we're talking about a lot of confirmation bias, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And just the kind of, they've said that we have an infodemic too in this pandemic, right? We just have this information onslaught and just this bubbling up of conspiracies where you can find things that will confirm whatever it is that you think. And you're in these bubbles where the news sources you get are simply links to confirming information.
I also think that it's important to note that this is happening during an election year. And so to admit that the pandemic has also been caused or made worse by government is to feed a narrative that may not be beneficial to certain political candidates. And so a lot of people are processing this information in a team mindset where you can't really accept that the people that you support might be at fault for it. So a lot of this belief, or at least the sympathy, is ideologically driven.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at MainCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Stephanie, a lot of these conspiracy theorists also seem to be rampant among a certain subgroup of people who support President Trump. I'm wondering if there are rampant conspiracy theories in the other side of people who are opposed to President Trump. Are there other things going around that are equally unbelievable but believed by many?
I want to say yes to that, but I don't know that I can. The research shows that political partisanship is kind of well spread out across conspiracy believers, right? That most everybody can believe conspiracies or conspiracy theories. But then what happens is we go to this place where we jump to those people who are actually willing to do things, right? Like bring a gun to a pizza place and blow it up looking for a sex trafficking ring. So when we jump to the violence, I don't know that we have that same type of behavior on the left, but I do know that immediately following the election of the president, there certainly were more unfounded associative narratives on the left that we're talking about, you know, the inevitable and imminent fall of President Trump.
Mm. And Ryan, so you study this, right? The political outsiders and their rhetoric.
Yeah, I specialize in third party candidates, especially, but people who don't traditionally fall into the mainstream parties. And
I think Trump obviously fits that bill. He's not a third-party candidate, but has never really been a part of the two-party system before. And so that really means that he's been willing to say things that other candidates haven't been able to say or would have gotten a lot of backlash for, and it's built into his brand of authenticity. And so I think he definitely feeds the conspiratorial culture, does not distance from it at all. As a matter of fact, in 2016, he accused Ted Cruz's father of being one of the JFK assassins. So there's a lot of evidence of his conspiratorial thinking.
Yeah. If somebody's listening to this conversation, Stephanie, and thinking, oh, this could never happen to me, I could never believe a conspiracy theory, that's just simply not true, correct? I mean, there's something that's known as the Mandela effect, and it's been proven how many people believe things that are untrue. Tell us about that.
Sure. There are, there was the one of the most common cited examples is the kind of satanic panic of the 1980s, where there were allegations that in various daycares there were sexual actions being taken by Satanists, and they were actually raising these children in order to be able to sacrifice them, etc. But it was shown to actually be not true, right? There was actually no evidence. And this is despite the fact that people were prosecuted and people went to jail and all of this kind of stuff. We also had similar things that went on with childhood sexual abuse. And that's not to say, and this is where it gets really difficult, because that's not to say that child sexual abuse is not a real thing, because obviously it is. But the malleability of memory is so difficult to understand, and we really don't, that sometimes parsing the differences between the false and the true gets really difficult.
And that's what you're talking about right in the beginning, Ryan, isn't it? That something that has a little bit of truth in it can be 98% false.
Well, and I think it's important that you brought up the term earlier, confirmation bias. So we oftentimes interpret these conspiracy theories based on our own sort of ideological lens or our own political affiliation, how we see the world. And so you're asking if people tend to believe in conspiracy theories, and a lot of polls suggest that the vast majority of Americans believe in at least one, right? Pretty extreme. There's a much smaller segment of the population that believes in many or almost all of them. But that's because some of them just seem reasonable based on what we generally think about the world, especially in our own politics.
Mm. Can you give me an example, Ryan, of a conspiracy theory that many people who don't otherwise believe in conspiracy theories believe?
Oh, that's a good question. But I would change the question a little bit and say that what we tend to see in the polls are that people who are a little bit more liberal have historically tended to believe in the 9/11 truth movement a little bit more, or at least found it somewhat believable, whereas the birther movement, right, spoke to conservatives. But there are many other conspiracy theories out there. I think the JFK conspiracy theory is really popular, and I think you see that poll pretty successfully as far as how many people believe in some version of that.
Interesting. Well, we are going to take a quick break. We're talking about conspiracy theories. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Breakwater in Portland, offering summer day camp programs for kids ages 3 to 18. Registration at enrichment.breakwaterlearning.org. And New England Cancer Specialists, proud to support the healthcare workers who are keeping people safe at this critical time, and Maine Public for keeping Mainers informed.
As the coronavirus took the U.S. by storm, two New Yorkers were out on their first date. They hit it off, and then...
Both of us kind of thought it was the other one that suggested it.
Yeah, like, who suggested that we quarantine together?
We just kind of stumbled into it.
I have not been to my place in 7 weeks.
I'm Elsa Chang, a pandemic love story, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
I'm Marco Werman from The World. Germany is letting kids go back to school in shifts. Italy eased its lockdown but remains vigilant. South Korea got its infection rate down to nearly zero, but they're still wearing masks. As communities across the U.S. work out their plans, our team is keeping track of how the rest of the planet is moving forward. It's The World. Join us.
And that's coming up this afternoon at 3 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we're talking about conspiracy theories. Have you heard a particularly outlandish or believable one? Our guests are Bates College professor Stephanie Kelly Romano. She began researching conspiracies in graduate school and has researched the X-Files, UFO discourse, birtherism conspiracies, and anti-vaxxers. Professor Ryan Neville Shepherd is also with us. He's a professor at the University of Arkansas, where he teaches and researches in the areas of political communication, rhetoric, and argumentation. We invite you to be part of the conversation. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now is Timothy Kaplowitz. He is a soon-to-be graduate, very soon, this Sunday, right, of Bates College. He majored in rhetoric and wrote his thesis earlier this year on the use of apocalyptic rhetoric in the QAnon conspiracy theory. Timothy, thanks for calling in.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
I can, and congratulations on this Sunday. How did you get interested in conspiracy theories?
I read a lot of Wikipedia. It was something that was a big hobby of mine. And I'd read, you know, a lot about history, or just I would click the random article button. But one of the things that really fascinated me and would help me to go down these, you know, 8-hour rabbit holes that I'm sure we're all so familiar with was conspiracy theories. And I read a lot of Area 51 and the JFK assassination that Dr. Neville Shepherd just got, and all of these different conspiracy theories. And it was kind of like this morbid fascination of mine. But it was always something that I felt was kind of separate.
Oh, shoot. Sounds like we're losing you. Timothy, I'm going to ask if... Are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Oh, hi.
So tell us about QAnon for those people who have not heard of it.
Sure, yeah. So QAnon is this conspiracy theory that started in late 2017 on 4chan, and it was essentially a user who claimed to be a government insider and prophesied this coming quote-unquote storm.
You know what, Timothy, Tim, I'm going to have you call back because you're doing that weird computer thing where you're all breaking up. So hopefully you can find a better spot and give us a call back. We're going to go to Mike, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. Mike, are you there? Go ahead. Shoot. Okay. My goodness. We're going to go to Kyle, who's calling from Frankfurt. Hi, Kyle. Go ahead.
Hi. So I would just say that I consider myself not a conspiracy theorist, but a conspiracy factist. And one of the inherent problems with parsing out evidence and conspiracy theories is much of it is hidden. The government keeps lots of documents classified. And years later, we find out something is true. For example, in the early 90s, Gary Webb and Freeway Rick Ross, I believe his name is, they tried to come out and point out that the CIA was running drugs for the Iran-Contra scandal. And in the early 2000s, they declassified the documents for it. So it's provable. Like, you can go on Google and you can look at the stuff. Several things are like that, you know, the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that was a conspiracy. People conspired to convince us that there were weapons and there weren't. You know, lots of people say, it's not possible. Too many people would have to be involved. Well, how many people were involved in hiding the weapons of mass destruction BS that they tried to push to us? Like, it's just... You have to take what the government says with a grain of salt. And then along the lines of people believing in different theories, for the last 3 years, we've had, you know, half the country believing in a conspiracy theory that was based on very little evidence. And I'm referencing Russiagate. The charges and the bombshells dropped every week, and then the retractions were a little blip. no one has been convicted of conspiring with Russia. Not one person.
Kyle, thank you so much for your call. And yeah. I think you make a really good point. Stephanie, you know, the fact that there actually are conspiracies out there sometimes.
Absolutely. You know, the tobacco industry has certainly had some conspiratorial things going on. We had Watergate. We had the Tuskegee syphilis experiments. So certainly historically, and I think this goes back to Ryan's point about there being a grain of truth. So certainly there are historical conspiracies that are true. And I think one of the things that Kyle brings up is this, the notion of like there's a grain of salt in it. And I think that when we're thinking about things, to think about them with skepticism as opposed to suspicion is one of the ways that I try to distinguish from conspiratorial thinking to kind of good critical thinking. And but certainly we don't oftentimes know the end of the story as we're thinking about these things. And so I think adopting the right orientation to information, a healthy skepticism, and good research practices totally is helpful in figuring stuff out.
That's pretty tricky, though, isn't it, Ryan? I mean, where do we draw the line between skepticism and suspicion? And how do we live our lives? We all need information to live our lives.
Well, I think what we try to do is not necessarily take a generalist approach to conspiracy theories where they're all just sort of counter-narratives from the lunatic fringe. I think some are going to make perfectly good points. And so what we just heard was about Gary Webb and the Dark Alliance stories from the San Jose Mercury News, which actually turned out to have quite a bit of truth behind them. But then there were other stories about fluoride being added to the water to trigger a part of our brain so the government can control our minds. There are some stories that go too far that we can pretty much discount once we hear these really tall fictional tales.
All right. I think we have Tim Kaplowitz back. Tim, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go back to explain to us what QAnon is.
Yeah. So QAnon was this conspiracy theory that started in late 2017 when a 4chan user claimed to be a government insider with this inside information on the inner machinations of the Trump administration. And one of their earliest and biggest claims was that the Mueller investigation was in fact not an investigation of Donald Trump's administration, that that was merely the cover story that they told people, but in fact the real investigation was of the Satanist liberal cabal that they alleged was the most powerful organization in America. And the idea was that the storm that Q prophesized, essentially, was going to be when the Mueller investigation concluded and all of these liberal elites were arrested.
And how many people believe this?
You know, it's really hard to say, but it's clearly something that a lot of people are sympathetic to. And it's something that, if you look on Twitter, a lot of people will often retweet something that's QAnon-related, and then when people call them out in reply, saying, like, hey, like, why are you retweeting their conspiracy theory? Sometimes people will say that they didn't even realize what they retweeted was part of this very large conspiracy theory.
Well, so interesting. Timothy, thanks for joining us today. Timothy Kaplowitz soon will graduate from Bates College. His thesis is on the use of apocalyptic rhetoric in the QAnon conspiracy theory. Moving on, we're going to go to John, who's calling from Portland. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hey, this has really been informative. I called with a point I'll still make, but other comments have had me thinking about how widespread real conspiracies can be. I'm a little worried about today's climate because we have a lot of people in America today who have want to close themselves off from what they call the mainstream media. And so if you're having a discussion with somebody and you cite a source that includes the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, or any other newspaper in the country, ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, MSNBC, et cetera, Harper's, Atlantic Monthly, New Yorker, whatever, then somebody writes it off as that's not true, it's the mainstream media. And this is dangerous when you're not accepting information from so many sources. It's basically like being part of a cult. And
sure.
I think it may be one of the largest cults we've ever seen, except perhaps the one that Mao ran a few years ago in China and some other situations like that.
John, Caitlin has also tweeted a very similar point. She says, a lot of conspiracy theorists I hear from distrust the monolithic media. Curious about how your panelists would respond to people who feel they can't trust traditional reporting. I will not go down my, I won't get on my soapbox about how there's no such thing as the media. We're all individuals doing our jobs. But Stephanie, to Caitlin's point and to John's point, how do you respond?
I think that, you know, it's a common cry that we hear now that this is going on, that the media can't be trusted. But what the research has shown is that people do trust people they know, right? So if you have someone who's forwarded one of these conspiracies to you or who's posted it on Facebook, there are several different strategies that researchers have shown to be effective, right? So what we can do is we can actually talk about, we can rebuke the information, we can kind of refute the actual information, or the source itself. But usually when those things come from someone that the person trusts or knows, they're a lot more open or receptive to kind of hearing about it. So when anti-vaxxers, for example, oftentimes if I have anti-vaxxers in my newsfeed, which I do, I'll oftentimes send that and they cite the number of studies that have been done. I will send them information about the quality of those studies that they're done by independent organizations that don't necessarily have a political affiliation. And so then they have a tendency to at least start to think about things differently.
And I would add that the change that you're going to produce in these arguments may not be immediate. What you're actually doing when you're building trust and arguing with people who are close to you is that you're changing their mind over a long, like over the long term. So you just have to commit to sort of that purpose and then trust that providing better information will influence how they see the situation.
Yeah, and a related comment. Go ahead, Stephanie.
I was just going to say, Jennifer, one of the things that you said earlier about the Mandela effect is also kind of relevant here in the sense that when we can bring up an example that's innocuous, right, one that isn't necessarily something that we're staking our identity on as much, it helps people to begin to question the absolute correctness of their beliefs. So, for example, lots of people believe that the actor Sinbad was evidently in a movie called Shazam, but the movie actually never existed. And so oftentimes if I bring that up to people, they'll be like, oh, yeah, I remember that movie. And it's like, well, actually, no, you don't. So when we can start in areas that are not necessarily politically charged or so important to people, we can oftentimes get inroads quicker.
And for people who haven't heard this term, the Mandela effect, it's sort of a collective misremembering, correct? And the reason it's called that is because people believed that Nelson Mandela had died mm-hmm. when he had not. Some other examples that are common are that "Play it again, Sam," was a line in Casablanca. Right. Or "Luke, I am your father," Luke, from Star yeah. Wars. Neither of those lines were ever spoken.
It's true.
All right. So we're going to go to Jay, who's calling from Old Orchard Beach. Hi, Jay. Go ahead.
Hi there. How are you?
Great.
Well, I could probably talk for the rest of the show. I'll try not to do that. I started being a skeptic, I think, since I was a little child and saw 2001: A Space Odyssey, where, you know, Hal ended up being part of a conspiracy himself in the movie, and went through the 70s watching Bigfoot and UFOs, and finally Phil Donahue came on and gave us a great outlet for looking at both sides of an issue, because he was very good at bringing people together and re-articulating somebody's comment and calling people out on what wasn't really true. And I kind of have taken on the skeptic side of things, and I'll say it weirdly like a religion, in that you have to kind of go through and check, what are my beliefs? I used to read the horoscope every single day because it was next to the comics in the newspaper. And, you know, you go through all these different things. What's the motivation for somebody to actually believe in a conspiracy theory? And you can get all the way to the point right now where I think you mentioned Maslow in the educational program earlier this morning, where somebody wants to be heard. That person wants to be a self-actualized in that case, and they want their voice to be heard, so they find something that they can peg on. And it's so easy for anybody with a credit card to just go and add a .org onto a website and type whatever they want to, and now they can cite their own website to say, well, this is what says here. And, you know, it could be whatever anybody wants to post.
Jay, thanks for calling with your perspective. A similar perspective from David on from Kevin, an email. As a physics and astronomy professor at Southern Maine Community College, I wade through numerous conspiracy theories that students bring with them each and every semester. I get them all. Vapor trails, lunar landing hoax, Philadelphia experiment, anti-vax, 9/11 truthers, intelligent design, ad infinitum ad nauseum. The challenge is to teach students the scientific method, how science really works, the peer review process, and that Google isn't research. Clearly, this is not being taught well in public schools. And with that thought, I have to go to another break. We'll be right back. We're talking about conspiracy theories on Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Seniors Plus, Western Maine's agency on aging, Meals on Wheels, and more for caregivers, older people, and adults with disabilities. SeniorsPlus.org. And First Peer, specializing in Shopify and offering strategic retail and e-commerce solutions in Portland and beyond. FirstPeer.com. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
Scientist Elizabeth S. Russell died in Sumsville, Mount Desert Island, on May 28, 2001. She spent most of her career at the Jackson Laboratory in Bar Harbor. Russell is most recognized for her groundbreaking work in pigmentation, blood-forming cells, and germ cells. She was the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship in 1958, and in 1983 was named one of 10 outstanding women of Northern and Eastern Maine. In 1991, she was elected to the Maine Women's Hall of Fame.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of DN Wealth Advisors and the Maine Seacoast Mission. Happy birthday, Maine! The Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus usually takes place at about 2 o'clock each weekday afternoon. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, each day's address is archive.mainepublic.org for later on-demand viewing or listening. Just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw and others is scheduled for 2 o'clock weekday afternoons and carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, mainepublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today we're talking about conspiracy theories. My guest, Stephanie Kelly Romano, who is an associate professor and chair of the Rhetoric, Film, and Screen Studies Department at Bates College. And Ryan Neville Shepherd is an assistant professor of communication at the University of Arkansas. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to go to a Facebook question from Gary. It's not that there haven't been a small percentage of conspiracy theories that were proven to be true. It's that the vast majority are based on fear and are always used to manipulate the less informed for selfish or malicious purposes. Once they enter the mind of those less inclined to use critical thinking skills, the conspiracy becomes truth without need of factual confirmation. When it becomes part of a political movement, you have the makings of a political cult. Ryan, do you believe this is true? Are they based on fear? Are there people out there trying to manipulate people because of their fearfulness?
Well, this gets to the difference between just a conspiracy theory and a disinformation campaign. I think disinformation campaigns exploit beliefs in conspiracy theories to further polarize people and with usually selfish objectives in mind. So if they're being used by perhaps Cambridge Analytica or whatever the equivalent would be in the 2020 campaign, it's specifically to try to get people to stay at home in the election, perhaps to benefit a specific party. So it does happen. Those fears can be exploited. It's something that we have to take seriously, and there are ways that our society could respond.
All right, we're going to go to Joe, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Hi.
Joe, go ahead. Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to preface my comment with certainly appreciate what other folks have said about having skepticism for what we hear, being able to think critically. And I think there's a lot of examples in history of how, you know, the world is round. I think we all accept, pretty much all of us, the world is round. But that was a provocative idea initially. Certainly other ones, I think we've come around to believe that women are just as smart, if not a lot smarter in most cases, than men. African-American people, same thing, way smarter, way bigger hearts than the rest of us in many cases. And those were provocative ideas for a while. I want to mention one contemporary, you know, model that's being floated around 5G. And I actually hold a degree in x-ray technology, an x-ray technician, being able to take x-rays. And I think it's important footnote in this conversation that x-rays were invented in 1895, and they were studied for about the first 20 years. A lot of people, x-rays are very safe now. If you have a broken bone, pretty darn safe. It's a good thing to do, get an x-ray. But before we got it right and figured out the risks and dangers and studied all the science, a lot of people died and got seriously injured in the first two decades of studying x-rays. And I think there's a similar paradigm with 5G and wireless, that it is a form of radiation. A little bit probably is just fine, but we don't know the long-term effects like cigarette smoking or something over 30 years. So I think it's something that we need to study more and not completely say, oh, this is 100% safe. Oh, this is 100% dangerous.
Right. Joe, I'm so glad you called and mentioned 5G, because Stephanie, 5G is one of the things out there that's there are many things going around about it. Some have some basis in scientific inquiry and some do not.
Sure. And I think that what Ryan's saying makes a lot of sense in terms of the fact that we do need to continue to study things, right? We always need to continue to learn. But just because we're continuing to learn and we don't know for sure that it doesn't do bad things, we shouldn't necessarily run and burn them down, because the studies that we have done so far show that they're actually safe, right? Despite the fact that we've all had cell phones up to our heads for the last however long, we haven't had mad incidents of brain cancer or of negative things. So I think, again, it's the healthy skepticism, it's balance.
All right, Joe, thank you. And I think we're getting to sort of something a lot of people are thinking about, because we're going to go to an email from Greg. He wrote, I wish we could follow a handy checklist to dispense with conspiracy theories, but some conspiracy theories turn out to be true. Once upon a time, most white people believed that police brutality was a conspiracy theory. Today, no one believes that. How do we contend with the fact that some theories that are on the fringe of society later turn out to be true? And how do we separate those from real conspiracy theories? I'm going to turn to you, Ryan, because Stephanie's already talked about that. I mean, excuse me. Yes, Ryan, because Stephanie's already talked about this a little bit.
Well, I think that what we do is we continue to debate about things. And some conspiracy theories typically take a gigantic leap in logic, where I talked about anti-fluoride conspiracies and typically how they're about mind control. We know that mind control, at least through government, addition of chemicals into the water, it's not a thing. So in some ways, we can usually just apply basic tests of media literacy to sort of understand conspiracy theories. And people who study media messages often talk about this CRAAP system, which is C-R-A-A-P, which is just trying to navigate the sources, understand whether or not they're current, they're relevant to a larger argument, assessing the authority of the people who are claiming these counter-narratives, then trying to assess their accuracy, weighing their evidence and their claims, and then trying to understand the purpose of the message. I think if we apply those kinds of systems to conspiracy theories, we can usually sift out the ones that we just know should not be taken seriously, and maybe some of those that we can have larger conversations about.
All right. Let's see. We're going to go to Larry in Bangor. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Yes. You know, somehow you've been beating around the bush in the beginning, you mentioned it. But, I mean, the child in the White House, by his own admission, though, I believe it was Leslie Stahl, says he purposely puts out false information so that people won't believe anything from the newspapers or from the mainstream media. He did it on purpose. He continues to do it on purpose.
Larry, thank you. Stephanie.
Yeah, unfortunately, he definitely does. I mean, I would argue that a big reason why he managed to actually make it into the White House was because of the birther conspiracy and the fact that he kept that alive and kept fanning it through social media and tweets in really indirect ways. Like, he would just simply retweet. And in that way, you don't necessarily have to assume responsibility for making the statement when you're just retweeting. But I think that there has been a larger, in the office of the presidency generally, there's been kind of this larger blaming of the media, so to speak. I know that I'm thinking about some of Obama's speeches. One of the easiest ways for a politician to try to unite Republicans and Democrats, independents and everyone, is to make the they someone outside of the people. And so you make the they the media. And so in that way, I think the media has served as somewhat of a, you know, served a larger political purpose and function for politicians. And now it's really, we're really reaping that with Trump.
Larry, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Max, who's calling from New York City. Hi, Max. Go ahead.
Hi. So one thing I actually witnessed in real time with conspiracies is that you can never disprove a conspiracy. You can only prove that it's a lot larger than you originally thought. And one really great example of this I've seen is with the COVID-19 second wave. And as you know, it's caused by 5G waves in the air. And someone I saw on Facebook went on this whole rant about how they haven't actually turned it on yet. And soon they will, and that will be the second wave, quote-unquote second wave. And so this conspiracy is now adapting with reality and is creating this scenario in which, yeah, we know there's going to be a second wave happening, but we know why there's going to be a second wave, and it's because they haven't actually turned on the 5G yet. And I think it's really interesting because it shows that these conspiracies are more amorphous and less dependent on a real anchor, a real narrative, and more on just sort of like justifying the previous conspiracy in a way that can cascade itself. Right?
Interesting, Max. Yeah, the point, Stephanie, they morph to fit the reality.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think, interestingly, some of the stuff that I study with apocalyptic groups and UFO cults, what we see is you know, when prophecies fail, how do groups account for that, right? So people claim it's going to be the end of the world and then it isn't, they scramble narratively very quickly in order to explain, well, you know, the aliens knew that we weren't ready and so they didn't come, or they haven't turned the 5G on yet because they would have been detected. There's always a reason to for it to kind of be pushed forward.
Max, thanks so much for your call. It's a good one. We have a tweet from Keith, and Keith wants to know, and do conspiracy theories stem from mental illnesses such as anxiety and paranoia?
I'll hit that one. I think that one of the best essays I think that was ever written on conspiracy theories came from Richard Hofstadter, who wrote about the paranoid style. And when he talked about the paranoid style to talk about conspiracy theories, he made a distinction. He said that he's not talking about paranoia in the clinical sense. Some people who are suffering from mental illness may believe in conspiracy theories, but we're talking about conspiracy theories in a very different way, very much how Hofstadter did in the 60s, where he said that the victim is not necessarily the individual, but their way of life in society. And that's what conspiracy theories are always about, a way of life or a group of people who are coming under attack. So I would make a distinction and say that we're talking about very different things here.
All right. An email from Mark. I'll throw this one to you, Stephanie. How do folklore themes from over the centuries play out within conspiracy theories?
Oh, that's a big question. I study myth and narrative also, and I think conspiracy theories are certainly one particular type of narrative. And for me, the distinction becomes one of function. So conspiracy theories, like we've talked about here today, really work to articulate some sort of evil or articulate and kind of circulate around some sort of fear. And folklore, I think, has a tendency to be a little bit less apocalyptic, and instead it oftentimes has a moral lesson to it. So I think that depending on the function of the story to society is how I'd make the distinction.
Okay. We're going to go to Tim quickly from Brewer. Tim, we're almost out of time, so if you could ask your question quickly, that'd be great.
Yeah, hi. I just want to make a quick comment. You know, I don't fall in line with conspiracy theories, but I am conservative. And my difficulty at this point is finding a news outlet that I feel has conservative viewpoints without being conspiracy theory type of viewpoint. So, that's the struggle I have, is where do I get news that isn't leaning more to the left than I want to lean, yet is not on that right side that is consistently wanting to make it a conspiracy.
Well, you're starting in a good place, an NPR station. What's your thoughts, Ryan?
Well, I always trust newspapers and multiple outlets. I think it's news consumption is sort of like any kind of diet. You don't want to go straight from a single source. The more sources you include, the better, in addition to NPR.
Stephanie, thoughts on that?
Yes, I absolutely agree. I also think that primary sources are a great thing. I think, oftentimes, and I read something recently where they suggested that we read horizontally, right? So when you have a browser window open and you read a story, if it seems unbelievable or if you want to know more, then you start researching the source. You start researching the information in it. You just Google it generally and see what other news sources or what other pseudo news sources are carrying that story. And in that way, you know, by the end of the time that you read a story, you should have 10, 15 browser tabs open. And in that way, you can feel like you're actually doing some due diligence when consuming information.
Well, thank you all for calling in today. Interesting conversation. And thank you to our guests. Stephanie Kelly Romano is an associate professor and chair of the Rhetoric, Film, and Screen Studies Department at Bates College. Ryan Neville Shepherd is an assistant professor of communication at the University of Arkansas, where he teaches and researches in the area of areas of political communication, rhetoric, and argumentation. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Today's main calling program will be rebroadcast at 7 this evening. You can find past editions of the program, as well as all sorts of helpful links and resources at maincalling.org. The program is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Stay with Maine Public for the latest update from CDC Director Nirav Shah. That's coming up in a few minutes on Maine Public Radio, television, and on the Maine Public website. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.